So this morning, we're going to discuss the book of Esther. Most of you probably are somewhat familiar with the book and have heard a sermon or two over the years. You might have been wowed with lessons on the courage of Esther in Sunday school or on Christian cartoons like VeggieTales and Mormon romance literature over when you were younger or in your teens. But today I'm going to take a different look that seems to imply that maybe Esther wasn't the heroine of old and the paragon of faith that maybe we've been led to believe. This isn't necessarily new information. In fact, as early as the second century, church fathers were at odds with the book of Esther even being considered for canonicity due to its general secular nature seen in the book, like Esther hiding her Jewish identity or showing her to not be too dissimilar to her Jewish counterparts in the past who have assimilated into pagan culture as opposed to holding fast to the ways of God. And also her premarital indiscretions or Mordecai's pride and vindictive acts that we see when he annihilates the enemies of the Jews when the tables are turned at the end of the book. The second century Archbishop of Sardis, Melito, did not list Esther among books to be considered for canonicity. Athanasius and multiple other fourth century church fathers showed some uncertainty about Esther's placement in the canon of Scripture. And ironically, the text that they struggled to accept was the later Greek text that had additions added to the earlier Hebrew text that we actually find in our Protestant Bibles. So these additions seem to be intended to polish up the characters, to show them to be more devout, moral, and God-fearing, and to make the book of Esther seem more religious. In fact, the version of Esther that we see in modern Protestant retellings, like in VeggieTales and such, is more similar to the later Greek, aka the Catholic and Orthodox versions. So these religiously cleansed Greek versions are what you'll find in the Catholic and Orthodox Bibles, but not in our Protestant version. Now for some basic introductory information. The book of Esther does not record who the author is. Josephus suggested that the author was Mordecai. Mordecai had access to the historical documents, as we read in Esther 2:23 and 6:1, a knowledge of Persian culture, and an interest in Jewish matters and affairs. Some have suggested Nehemiah. Augustine thought it might have been Ezra. No one seems to have suggested Esther herself as a possible author. Regardless, the person who did write it clearly had a good knowledge of Persian culture, as well as Jewish history and culture, and was a brilliant storyteller. But exactly who that was is not mentioned, so we can only speculate. As far as the date it was written, after 464 BC makes sense, which is when Xerxes is presumed to have died when you read of the summary of his reign in Esther 10:2. And before 331 BC seems likely, for this is when the Greeks rose to power under Alexander the Great, and there seems to be no trace of Greek influence in the book. As for style of literature or genre, most evangelical scholars will still see Esther as a historical narrative, but some have labeled it a historical romance or historical novel along with other classifications. Regardless, it seems to be seen as a masterpiece of literature by secular and religious critics alike. However, as just stated, there are some evangelical scholars who are more apt to see Esther as falling more into the realm of historical novel or fiction as far as genre goes, kind of like an extended parable, sharing how not to behave while also showing God's providence and faithfulness along the way. Viewing Esther as a novel or extended parable doesn't necessarily discredit the book or the Bible. It just requires the reader that holds this position to read it in light of the genre specification, much like some evangelicals who see the book of Job as an extended parable. Hebrew scholar John Levison writes, "This is not to say that the book is false, only that its truth, like the truth of any piece of literature, is relative to its genre." Personally, I'm not ready to throw my hat entirely into that ring just yet, but would have a hard time disparaging a brother or sister in Christ who did, because the evidence is pretty convincing. So why is Esther in our canon of Scripture? And why was Esther written? And why is it esteemed so highly, especially amongst the Jews today? First, I would point out that it is the only place in the Bible that establishes or speaks to the festival of Purim. Purim is a Jewish festival that celebrates a big win for the Jewish people, the time when the Jews overcame their enemies, when God saved and preserved them from certain annihilation and death. Secondly, a major theme in Esther that seems prevalent throughout is God's providence and faithfulness. Regardless of what the world leaders and others are doing, and regardless of what situation God's people are in and what they are doing, God's plans are always realized, even when things seem hopeless. Our merciful God is always faithful, even when his people are not. And this could be the major takeaway when you consider that God does preserve the Jews in the end, even when their acts leading up to the end seem to be more self-serving, hostile, and assimilatory to the culture around them. Worth noting is that Esther is not mentioned in the New Testament, in other places in the Old Testament, and not in the Qumran scrolls, aka the Dead Sea Scrolls. However, Ruth, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon are not mentioned in the New Testament either, and that fact alone doesn't disqualify any of these books from canonicity. And since Esther was one of the last Old Testament books written, you might expect it not to be mentioned in other Old Testament books. Now, just because it's not been discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls doesn't necessarily mean it's not there. There are many charred, disintegrated, and faded fragments in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the fact that it's a small work might play a part. And technically, the Book of Nehemiah doesn't show up in the Dead Sea Scrolls either. And let's not forget that the Qumran community is not the arbiter of the biblical canon. In fact, they're a little crazy. Now, it is true that these concerns regarding Esther's absence in the New Testament, Old Testament, and Dead Sea Scrolls, along with some other concerns mentioned earlier, have led the book of Esther provoking some strong negative reactions from some folks over the years who've denounced the book as secular, largely because of questionable moral choices made by characters in the text and its narrow Jewish nationalism and vindictive spirit that we see when the Jews triumph over and essentially slaughter their enemies at the end of the book. Besides the early church fathers mentioned earlier, Calvin, Luther, and other reformers were hesitant when it came to the book of Esther. At the time of the Reformation is when the Protestants locked into the original Hebrew, with the Catholics and Orthodox sticking with the more religious and later Greek versions. Calvin did not write a single sermon or commentary on the book. Luther wrote that he was hostile to the Esther and wished that it didn't exist at all, for they Judaize too greatly and have much pagan impropriety. Luther seemed to struggle with both the questionable moral choices made by characters in the text and the narrow Jewish nationalism and vindictive spirit. Similarly, Samuel Sandmill, a Jewish scholar, stated, "If somehow or other the canon was to be open in the 20th century, I would be among those who would vote to exclude Esther." That's pretty tiny. Listen carefully then. So regarding historical context, I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with the lead up to the information found in the Book of Esther. Judah was taken by the Babylonians in 597 BC by Nebuchadnezzar due to their unfaithfulness. So Jeconiah, king of Judah, and his court, other prominent citizens and craftsmen are deported to Babylon. This is the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. Then in the early 530s, after that, Cyrus, king of Persia, conquered Babylon and also issued an edict allowing Jews to return to Jerusalem and the land of Judah. We heard about this in the Book of Ezra last week. And remember, the northern kingdom had already been taken by the Assyrians about 125 years earlier. And the Medes took the Assyrians about 100 years after that with the help of the Babylonians. But the Persians under Cyrus took the Medes about 10 years before he took Babylon. So basically, all the displaced Jews were under the Persian control when the contents of the Book of Esther takes place. Now, the Book of Esther takes place after Cyrus's edict that we read about in Ezra. And our main characters, Esther and Mordecai, are among the diaspora, for they didn't return from the exile but settled down in the foreign land. I would guess that most of you in this room are pretty familiar with the general storyline of the Book of Esther. So Esther is this Jew still living in exile, living in Persia, modern-day Iran, in the capital of Susa. She is cared for by her cousin Mordecai. In the opening chapters of the book, we learn that King Xerxes, this is about four kings after Cyrus, held a banquet and wanted to show off Queen Vashti. But the queen refused to comply and was subsequently sent back to the harem, never to be in the presence of Xerxes again. The king's advisors worried that if Vashti could show such disrespect to the king, then the rest of the women in the empire might get the idea that they could do the same thing. So they determined to kind of go hard on Vashti, kind of as an example for all other women. As you might surmise, Xerxes was less tolerant than his Persian predecessors like Cyrus, who was more tolerant of other religions and let the Jews go back to their homeland. Xerxes was a harsher and more brutal and ruthless warrior and a jealous lover. Xerxes then searches far and wide for a new queen, and Esther was one of the many women brought to the king's harem. And Mordecai, likely a eunuch, since he had access to the women's quarters, kept an eye on Esther's situation. She was eventually taken to the king after about a year, and he found favor with her and named her the new queen. Now, something you might not have considered, or maybe you have, is the moral situation that Esther's been put in. By being put in the harem, she's in the situation to be taken to bed by the king at his whim. Granted, she was likely in a submit or die, or at minimum, submit or be cast out situation if she denied the king's request to go to him. But she chose to go to the king and quite likely slept with him when summoned. She technically had a choice throughout, maybe not a great choice, but a choice nonetheless. And I think Carrie said this words out loud: there are consequences far worse than death. Quote that. Now we know that in this position, Esther becomes a critical person in the saving of the Jews, if you're familiar with the rest of the story. But I doubt that this is what Esther had in mind when she entered the king's harem and eventually went to bed with him a year later and essentially marries a Gentile. It might be concluded, at least at this time, that Esther and maybe Mordecai too had some selfish motives in mind early on, possibly, and were likely not living out their Jewish faith in this pagan culture. And remember, we shouldn't look favorably on sin, even when that sin leads to something good. Remember Romans 6:1-2. Paul writes, "Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? By no means." Another question that should pop into your head is, why are Esther and Mordecai still in Persia? They had the opportunity to go back to their homeland, but chose to stay with their captors. It might be that they grew accustomed to their pagan captors' ways. Much like their Jewish predecessors, Esther and Mordecai seem to have assimilated into the ways of the pagan world around them. Even their names, Esther and Mordecai, are associated with Persian gods. Esther in Hebrew means star and is derived from an old Persian word and is associated with the Babylonian goddess of love, Ishtar. And the name Mordecai means follower or servant of Marduk, another Babylonian god. And a thorough reading of Esther doesn't seem to lead one to see Esther or Mordecai calling on their god. In fact, Esther is instructed to hide her Jewishness. However, if you look at it a little differently, this kind of speaks of the overarching theme that I mentioned earlier that we see throughout the book of Esther, that of God's providence and faithfulness. In spite of man's choices and situations, God's plan is achieved. Similar to how we see God's plan unfold with Joseph, even when Joseph's brothers sold him off to slave traders. Similar to how Moses is saved and leads the Jews out of Egypt when Pharaoh intended to have him killed. Even through Esther's premarital decisions, God's plan to save the Jews is done, regardless of the situation Esther found herself in and the choices she makes. Maybe the takeaway is more God is faithful even when his people are not, versus Esther is a model of virtue. So I'm sure you've heard that Esther is the only book in the Bible that doesn't mention the name of God, but some would argue that Song of Solomon also fits that bill. But even if the name of God is not mentioned, God is seen throughout, and that could be part of the point of the style of writing. God is seen throughout the book of Esther without being named through his providence and faithfulness. And it's possible that the author did not want to associate the name of God with the questionable decisions of the Jewish main characters. Now, following Esther's promotion to queen, we see a little side story unfold when we see Mordecai foil an assassination attempt on the king's life. It all reads kind of like a John Grisham novel with twists and turns and plot twists, heroes, antagonists, protagonists, romance, suspense, war, murder, irony. And as stated earlier, the writer of Esther is clearly a brilliant storyteller. Next, we read about Haman, one of King Xerxes' advisors, being honored and elevated, and Mordecai refusing to kneel before him. We're not told why Mordecai would not kneel and honor Haman. Some have suggested that this was a situation similar to how Daniel would not worship the king as a god. But Haman's not expecting worship, merely respect, which was acceptable for the Jews to offer. It might be that Mordecai just didn't like him or respect him. I even read of a theory, and this seems pretty plausible, that maybe suggests that Mordecai and Haman were archenemies, kind of like the Hatfields and McCoys. Mordecai was a Benjamite and an ancestor of King Saul. Haman is referred to as Haman the Agagite in Esther 3:1 and is likely related to King Saul's enemy Agag that we read about in 1 Samuel 15. But regardless, it seems like that Mordecai was digging his heels, maybe even being a little prideful. This enraged Haman, and he decides to entice the king to get back at Mordecai by having the king sign a decree to have the Jews killed and annihilated on a specific day in the future that was chosen by lot, or pure, P-U-R in Hebrew, as in Purim. We'll talk more about that in a second. It also notes that Haman offered a large sum of money to the royal treasury at the same time that he suggested this to the king. Now, as you might expect, this distressed Mordecai greatly, so he sent word to Esther to go to the king to plead with him for the Jews. And it should be noted that Esther's identity as a Jew is not known by the king at this time. In fact, the way that Haman described the people in which the decree was made to destroy, it isn't really clear if the king knew that it was the Jewish people that was the intended target. When Esther got Mordecai's message, she reminded him that anyone approaching the king in the inner court without being summoned is to be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their life. And given the fact that Xerxes seems to have a bit of a temper and can be a bit brash, casting out Vashti for refusing to come and agreeing to eliminate a people group when Haman gives him some vague reason and a bit of money, Esther's legitimately worried. Mordecai then says to Esther, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." And there's that famous verse that most of you probably know. "And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." This is where Esther kind of seems to move from potentially self-serving to becoming more of a selfless agent, fighting and sacrificing for her Jewish counterparts. She says, "Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, nights or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Now, not to dog on Esther too much, but what else is she going to do? If she doesn't go to Xerxes, it looks like she's dead anyway. So though she seems to be showing a bit of courage and is fighting for her people, she's still saving her own skin. And remember, when she joined the harem, hid her identity, slept with the king outside of wedlock, married the Gentile king, she wasn't in the midst of cooking up this plan to save her people. Her people weren't even threatened at that time. And a side note, even though the name of God is not mentioned, when Esther asks the Jews to come together to fast, and fasting could assume praying, but not necessarily, but it could also just mean that she is fasting as a form of lament because she actually thinks it's all just that hopeless. Who's she fasting to, though, and possibly praying to? Obviously God. So maybe Esther isn't being the most observant Jew at this point in her life, but she seems to be at least holding on to a remnant of faith by going to the Lord, by fasting, and possibly praying too. And similarly, when Mordecai mentions that if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, he might just be saying that God will get this done, God's providence, through another source, vessel, or person, or supernaturally if she doesn't act. God's actions and plans are not limited by human actors. However, it's not clear if that's exactly what Mordecai meant. As you're probably aware, Esther goes to the king's court. Xerxes is pleased with her and holds out the gold scepter, so the first hurdle is over. She doesn't die immediately. She invites Xerxes and Haman to a banquet. At the banquet, she asks them to come to another banquet. So Haman's pretty pumped to be invited back to another banquet. But after leaving the initial banquet, Haman sees Mordecai, and Mordecai shows no respect to him. This irritates Haman to the point that he sets up a sharpened pole to have Mordecai impaled on it if the king would agree. And interestingly enough, he was invited to that second banquet the very next day, so he'd get a chance to talk to the king. And oddly and ironically, during the sleeping hours between the first and second banquet, Xerxes couldn't sleep and ordered that the Book of the Chronicles be read to him. He's reminded of the assassination plot that Mordecai foiled back in the day and asks what has been done for Mordecai at that time, or what had been done at that time, and finds out that he was not honored or rewarded. So the king thinks that something should be done to honor him. And crazily enough, at that very moment, Haman is coming to ask the king to let him kill Mordecai. Apparently, he couldn't wait till the second banquet, which was just later that day. The king asked Haman a question in a very vague way. Basically, what should we do for a man the king wants to honor? Haman, thinking he's talking about him, says that he should put royal robes on the honored person and have him paraded through the streets by another nobleman. And in an ironic twist, the king tells Haman to walk Mordecai, his sworn enemy, around the town on a horse while robed in royalty. Haman goes home dejected and senses the writing on the wall. As soon as he got back, though, he is escorted right back to the king's quarters for banquet number two. And this very coincidental sequence, and along with some other concerns mentioned earlier, and some absent historical records, are some of the reasons that some evangelical scholars feel Esther to be a fictitious parable of sorts. Anywho, Esther finally makes her request to the king. She says, "If I found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition, and spare my people. This is my request, for I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed and annihilated. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king." And Xerxes, completely oblivious, it seems, asks who she's talking about that would want to destroy and kill Esther and her people. And she points out Haman. Xerxes goes into the garden in a rage. Haman goes to Esther to plead for his life and is caught on the same couch as Esther when the king comes back. Haman is immediately grabbed and conveniently and ironically impaled on the very pole that he set up for Mordecai. And in another twist, Esther is given the entire estate of Haman, and Mordecai is given the signet ring that was on Haman's finger and power in the land. Now remember, the Jews are still set for destruction according to the king's original order. Now supposedly, anything written could not be revoked, so the next best option they could come up with was to make it lawful for the Jews to fight back by destroying, killing, and annihilating any who might attack them. This pleased the Jews and scared some of the non-Jews in the area into converting to Judaism out of fear. Then, when the time came that was drawn by lot, or P-U-R, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the Jews took the offensive and attacked their enemies all over Persia, killing thousands, then rested on the 14th day on the 12th month. The Jews in Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire, where the king's royal palace was, where Esther was, repeated the fighting on the next day, the 14th, and rested on the 15th day of the 12th month. Mordecai is elevated and then establishes the festival of Purim, or festival of lots. So Purim and Hanukkah are the only Jewish holidays not mentioned in the Torah. Now, Hanukkah is not a required Jewish holiday. Hanukkah was established during the intertestamental period after the Maccabean Revolution, when the Jews captured Jerusalem and rededicated the temple in 164 BC. This feast of dedication is mentioned in the New Testament in John 10. Purim is only mentioned in Esther, but some have argued that the unnamed festival mentioned in John 5:1 might be referring to the festival of Purim, and Purim is a required Jewish holiday. So the name Purim comes from the word lot, or pure, in Hebrew, as in Haman cast lots as to when the Jews would be destroyed. Purim is celebrated annually by the Jews and takes on a bit of a wild and crazy atmosphere. Biblical studies professor Stephen Knoll writes this: "The central act of Purim is the reading of the Esther scroll, accompanied by raucous mocking at the name of Haman and his sons and congregational recitation of the verses of redemption. The feast is also accompanied by a carnival-like atmosphere, puppet shows, comic plays, drinking contests, the burning of a Haman effigy, and the election of a Purim king." Kind of sounds like a Thursday night at Wendell's. And as I mentioned earlier, this vindictive act of annihilating their enemies in this carnival-like and nationalistic holy day seems to be some of the reasons that Luther and others found umbrage with the Book of Esther. Now, I would argue that just because Mordecai and Esther have some alleged moral shortcomings doesn't mean that we have to come to some sort of defense for their weaknesses or see these faults as some kind of implied condemnation of Scripture. The immoral conduct of Esther and Mordecai, so Esther hiding her identity, joining the harem, likely engaging in premarital relations with Xerxes, and then marrying a Gentile, or Mordecai's support of her in these matters, His pride exhibited towards Haman or supporting the slaughter of their enemies after the tables were turned doesn't mean that God ordered these events. Everything found in the Bible is not to be emulated per se. Sometimes in these biblical narratives, the author is merely reporting, not necessarily endorsing such behaviors. And sometimes the biblical narrative shows how we should not act. This concept could be garnered whether you see Esther as a historical narrative or extended parable. Esther and Mordecai's questionable acts did result in the deliverance of the Jews, but their success does not prove that the means used were good and pleasing to God. In the book of Esther itself, God neither praises nor commends their actions or behavior, but the author simply relates what took place without blame or approval. There are lots of examples of people committing immoral or questionable acts in the Bible. Consider Gideon's fleece, or Lot's daughters sleeping with their father, or any number of patriarchs marrying multiple wives, as an example, that are not outrightly rebuked by God. All we see in those instances is silence. And that silence can express God's disapproval just as powerfully as his rebuke, truthfully. And though Esther and Mordecai are elevated after these events, there's no historical evidence showing that the Jewish people entered a period of blessing after these events. For all we know, Esther's status as queen and Mordecai's elevation could be human rewards for human behavior. Regardless, though, we know that God's will is not interrupted or stymied by the acts of the people, of his people. Again, God's will occurs regardless. This could just show how merciful and faithful God is, even to an unfaithful people. Sometimes God uses us as vessels, and sometimes he acts, and sometimes he turns our interference into his good purposes. But regardless, his perfect will occurs regardless of human interaction, even when it's hard to see or discern because God seems hidden and seems to be acting within the confines of the natural goings-on of the world. Now, this apparent hiddenness of God could be intentional by the author, and there are many theories out there suggesting a lot of reasons or ideas as to why, but Old Testament professor David Howard put it best, I thought. The author of Esther seems to be affirming, on the one hand, that God indeed is involved with his people, so God's providence, and on the other hand, that perceiving this involvement is sometimes difficult. That's God's hiddenness. While the author and his readers, us included, know rationally that God is always present and in control, the experience of life shows that the specific manifestations of his presence are not always so clear. Which leads to my final point that we've kind of been woven through today's sermon. Though the book of Esther does not mention God by name, he is seen throughout the book. Besides seeing God's providence and faithfulness throughout the book of Esther, we see fasting and possibly praying to God and a possible expectation that God will achieve his goals regardless of how the human actors behave. Regardless of Esther's moral mishaps or Mordecai's vengeance, God accomplishes his will no matter what. If God wants something to be done back then or even in present day, it will be done supernaturally within the confines of the natural goings-on of the world, through us, his vessels, and also in spite of us and our actions and unfaithfulness, even when it isn't so obvious or clearly visible. Our God is a merciful and faithful God, even when we are faithless. This is seen throughout the book of Esther and ever so evident in the Father's gracious gift of salvation through Christ his Son, 400 years later, to yet another stubborn and undeserving lot that eventually would include us 2,000 years later. Thanks.